talk just after as we get to turn the page and speak of something that is far more helpful and hopeful, both helpful and hopeful. I mean, the reason that we have the discussion in the first hour of the program, and the reason that we cover and analyze the news of our day, is because God specifically asked us if we want to participate in His covenant. Now, it's our choice. He is absolutely into free will. So this is not an order that you have to obey. There are no orders that you have to obey in His Torah. In fact, His Torah does not mean law. It means teaching. And so this is your choice. But He says if you choose to have a relationship with Him, if you want to be part of His family, then there are five requirements. Now, you don't have to pay attention to any of these. You can ignore them. You can reject them. You can oppose them. You can do whatever you want. It's your choice. But if you want to be part of His family, there are some terms and conditions. And the first of those is to walk away from your country. Now, specifically, the country He asks us to walk away from is Babylon, which He goes to great lengths throughout His Torah, prophets, and Psalms to specifically tell us that the very nature of Babylon is religion and politics, that He wants us to disengage from religion and politics. And that, and what He's saying is that that's the prerequisite for participating in His covenant family. God's not going to allow religion or politics, militarism or jaundiced economic schemes into His home. So if that's what drives you, if that's what, you know, really trips your trigger, if you identify yourself first and foremost as a Republican or a Democrat or a Tea Partier or a Libertarian, if that's how you identify yourself, if you identify yourself first and foremost as a Muslim or a Roman Catholic or a Protestant Christian, if you identify yourself first and foremost as a capitalist, is that how you identify? If you say, you know, I'm a Marine, that's who I am. If that's your identity, you're not going to have a relationship with God. Not until you say, you know, I'm willing to disassociate myself with that. And so the reason that we spend so much time in the first hour talking about political institutions and military invasions and economic schemes and political malfeasance is that you know that there's a reason that God said you need to walk away from it. It's corrupt. It's misleading. It's suicidal. It's counterproductive. And then once you know that, then you're in a position to say, all right, what does God have to offer instead of these things? Because it's a choice. It's one or the other. You can't have both. You can't be patriotic and saved. You can't be political and adopted. You cannot be religious and be engaged in a relationship with Yahweh. It's one or the other. And so the contrast between these two things is really important. And that's why in the Torah and Prophets, God spends almost as much time exposing and condemning the political and religious options as He does presenting what He is offering. They are completely different. There's no overlap at all between them. So as we transition to what God is offering, we find that His idea of a perfect relationship was described in Eden. Man was conceived in His image. We were given a nesama, which means that we were given the opportunity to think, to exercise good judgment. We were given a nefesh soul so that we could be observant and we could respond to what we were observing. And then this nefesh so that we could understand and process what we were observing. We were given free will, so there was a choice. And we were given mortal life, which we could extend based upon our choices. And the protective enclosure was conducive to life, as is God's family, His covenant. And it was named the protective enclosure of Eden, which means great joy, perfect happiness, total bliss and satisfaction. That's God's idea of how our relationship should be. So as we continue to study what He said, after telling us that He was going to create a counterpart, something that corresponded, something that was beneficial for Adam, so that he would have a better appreciation of the kind of loving relationship that God was conceiving through his familial covenant, so that he would understand how men and women come together as mother and father to conceive and then to raise children and the joy that is associated with that. He said to Adam that he was going to create for him his counterpart, his corresponding counterpart. So this is the statement, Larry, that he shares next. Yahweh, he did not say the Lord. The Lord is Satan's title. You know, the Lord is the one who owns, who controls, who manipulates slaves. God's name, one and only name, is Yahweh. Yahweh Almighty caused the man Adam to fall deeply asleep. First use of anesthesia, I suppose. And while he slept, he grasped hold of one of the ribs from his side, and he closed its place with flesh. And the rib, Yahweh Almighty, took relationally and beneficially from the man, Adam, and he built a woman and wife, an Isha. And he brought her to the man, Adam. Now, there's a lot of things here, Larry, that are worth considering. The first of those, of course, is the one that most people get right away, which is that by saying that the woman, wife, would be taken out of a, conceived from a rib, that means that we are made of the same substance, and that we are designed to be equal. He did not take the woman and make her from the man's skull, nor the man's toe, nor the man's hand, but a rib. What does what do our ribs, not only, you know, from a top to bottom, this is right in our midst, but what do the ribs protect, Blair?
Well, they protect our heart, lungs. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yep.
You know, they protect.
Yep, heart and lungs. That is the primary purpose of the ribs, is they protect our heart and lungs. The breath, which is the purpose of our lungs, is to breathe. Do you know what the Hebrew word is for breath and to breathe?
I do, and I can't. I can't
think
of it.
Yeah, as soon as I say it, you'll say, "Oh yeah, that's right." Nefesh. It's the same word for soul.
Right.
The breath of life.
Yeah. Right.
The breath of life. Our nefesh is the breath of life, and so that's one of the two things that our ribs protect. Our nefesh, soul, the breath of life. What does the set apart spirit associate with that enables us to enter God's family? Is it our physical bodies or is it our souls?
It's our nefesh.
Yeah, our souls. The breath of life. It's our souls. Now, the next thing that the ribs protect is our heart. What is the heart considered the seat of in humanity?
Judgment.
Yeah, it's interesting that most people would immediately go to emotion. And, you know, it is true that we do equate, particularly in today's world, the heart with emotion. But Larry is actually more correct. In the ancient world, when you spoke of the heart, rather than of speaking of emotion, you were speaking of judgment. And there's a reason for this. And so when God speaks of the heart, this is something worthy of consideration, something I really missed until quite recently, is that the reason that the heart was considered the seat of good judgment is that when you process something in your mind, you know it. When you observe it with your eyes, you hear it with your ears, you come to know it. Knowing it is one thing. But incorporating it in what you know into your life so that it becomes the part of the fabric of your life so that you not only understand it, but come to fully integrate what you come to know into the fabric of your life, into your attitude, into your motivation. That then is what guides your judgment. And that's why the heart was considered the seat of judgment. And so we look at the set-apart spirit. What is her primary role in the lives of the covenant's children?
It's actually to feed us that judgment, to feed us.
Yeah, to teach us.
She works right with us and to provide understanding. It teaches.
Right,
teaches.
Right. Exactly. You know, when you're reading Yah's word, God set up his testimony in such a way that it requires us to make connections to understand. You can read his word and observe what he has to say, and you can know what he has to say, and you can come to know him. But the transition from knowing to understanding is all about making connections. And she helps us make those connections so that we come to understand when we're studying his word. So she is a considerable contributor to this process of not only understanding, but integrating what we've come to learn into the fabric of our lives. So this woman that God is creating is now symbolic of those things which just so happen to be symbolic of the spirit. Now, what's also interesting here is that he built a Isha. An Isha. You ever heard the Hebrew word Isha used in another important context? You know, we just celebrated the Day of Reconciliations, where we're asked to come to answer a summons, answer an invitation. Right. And come into the presence of what, Larry?
Isha.
Isha. Same word, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Isha is the exact same word. The Ish, interestingly, is the Hebrew word for fire, for radiant energy, for the light that is and the warmth, the enlightenment that emanates from fire. Fire was the symbol of judgment. Fire was the symbol of enlightenment. Fire was the symbol of nourishment, because you could cook your food and to be nourished. It was the symbol of communities coming together, because they would all gather around the fire. And it was the symbol of light. God used it as the symbol for himself, not only as the pillar of fire, but also as the fire above Mount Horeb as he was providing the Torah. We'll return to why Ish became Isha. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering Yah's testimony where he said, Yah Almighty caused the man Adam to fall deeply asleep. And while he slept, he grasped hold of one of his ribs from his side and closed up the place with flesh. And the rib Yah Almighty took relationally and beneficially from the man Adam, he built a woman and wife, an Isha, and he brought her to the man, Adam. So we're considering a word here which is just really profound in its implications. Isha. It is the Hebrew word for wife and for woman. It is also the Hebrew word for a mother, particularly as an adoptive mother. But it's also the same, indistinguishable, the text from the feminine for fire. You know, most languages have a masculine and feminine of many nouns, and that is the case with Hebrew. Yeah, in fact, masculine and feminine really have huge advantages when communicating. It's a shame that English is one of the few languages that doesn't have a masculine and feminine. But Hebrew does, and Isha is, in addition to meaning female, partner, wife, woman, and mother, also means fire. But not just any fire. This is fire from a feminine or maternal perspective. Now, Yahweh will tell us that he is light, and during his presence on earth, when he doesn't accept a corporeal form, he dials down some of his energy, and that energy, that light, appears to us as fire. Now, God, during many of his invitations for us to be called out and meet, says specifically that he's encouraging us to not only answer the invitation, but to approach and come near the Isha. So what is the Isha? Well, we're being told here that it's the woman, wife, partner, part of an individual, that the female aspect of a marriage, and it's the light of fire. So when Yahweh, in these seven invitations to meet, as he routinely does, encouraging us to come into the presence of the Isha, and he's just told us that this Isha was taken from a place that protects our breath, our nefesh, that protects our seat of judgment, our heart.
And our soul.
And he's going to name this nefesh chawa, which means life giver. Man, it's pretty hard not to see that God is saying, you know, there's a maternal aspect of this relationship, this covenant relationship. And it's about a mother and father having children. And I am trying to give you every clue that I can give you so that you understand the role of the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit, in your lives, particularly as it applies to the covenant. And he not only did this with Chawa and the relationship between Chawa and Adam, but he also did it with Sarah and the relationship between Sarah and Abraham. So it's exactly the same metaphor. The difference in the names is also instructive. You know, Chawa means life giver, and Sarah means to engage and endure. You know, Sarah is the middle aspect of the compound name Yisrael. Ish is individuals. Sarah means to engage and endure, and El is God, individuals who engage and endure with God. And of course, Sarah's grandson was Jacob, who was renamed by God Yisrael. The first child of the covenant, of course, was laughter, Yishak. So God's really giving us an enormous amount of information here that if we're observant, if we're closely examining, carefully considering what he's saying, now when he uses Isha in four of his seven invitations to be called out and meet with him that provide the path that the covenant's children walk from our polluted world with religious and political entities that corrupt into God's perfect home, which is shelter, sukkah, over these six steps which lead to the seventh. Now we have the Isha defined for us, don't we? We're asked to walk in the light of our spiritual mother. The light of the Ruach Kodesh.
Can I point out a common myth here?
Yeah. 15 seconds.
Men and women have the same amount of ribs.
Yeah.
The Sunday school myth is not true.
Yeah, this is true. Yeah. God said that he made the woman out of the rib of man, but he also said that he repaired the flesh of the man. He left Adam. We're talking about the nature of the creation of woman to be a wife of the man. There was a reason that this particular woman had to be taken out of man. But before I get there, Larry, I want to make a point that is really important. Yahweh said that he closed up its place with the flesh, with basar. Okay. Now he thought that that what he was doing with man and with woman was a very good thing, and they were both flesh, and he specifically dealt with the flesh, basar. Did you know that Paul was a Gnostic?
Yes.
Okay. Do you know a little bit about what Gnosticism represents?
Yeah, they really they embrace all religion and religious ideas.
Yeah, it's mostly spiritualism. The idea of Gnosticism was the predominant Greek philosophy of Paul's day, and Paul recognized that if he could model his new religion, his new faith, after the predominant mythology of the day, that it would be much easier for him to prevail, for him to convince people to accept his faith than reject the Torah. So, Gnosticism was a spiritual idea that was promoted by the likes of Plato and Socrates. And the idea was that the physical world was flawed, and therefore it was evil, and that there was a spiritual counterpart for everything that was physical that was perfect. And that while you could not prove the spiritual, you could take the spiritual on faith. And the idea became, and the way that the Gnosticism developed, is there was a dimmerage. There was this old and decrepitated arcane god that created the physical world, and he was essentially enslaving, and he was mean-spirited, controlling, but there was a spiritual revival where a new god emerged that was able to replace the old god that was liberating and enlightening and freeing and saving and all merciful. And that became the one or spirit. And so the thought process of Gnosticism is the flesh is evil and it's enslaving and corrupting and controlling. And that which is spiritual is good. Now, one of the things, of course, the Gnostics did is that they assumed that anything that was associated with sensuality, with sexuality, was bad, which is why in Christianity today, what you see is this puritanical view that sensuality is bad. God doesn't, in fact, God is actually creating a woman to be sexually attracted to man and vice versa. And, you know, I think he did a very fine job from my perspective. I like the way women look and feel, and, you know, I enjoy being married. I'm on board, man. I enjoy being married. I think he did a really fine job. But what's important here is that Paul relegated the Torah in his letter to the Galatians to the flesh, and he relegated his faith to the spirit. And that's the debate. That's the divide. It's a Gnostic argument that Paul promoted.
Yeah, I've had this debate many times, by the way, and people say, well, Larry, you're living in the flesh. When I tell them, you know, a male son really has to be circumcised to be a part of the covenant. Yeah. I mean, and I'm living in the flesh. Well, yeah, I am living in the flesh.
Yeah, right.
I've got flesh all over my
skeletal tissue. Yeah, that's right. God views the flesh as being good. Paul and Christianity as being bad. And the sign of the covenant was in the flesh, and not just in the flesh, but in a very important part of the male genitalia, the male makeup. It's the part of the male creation here that is responsible for conceiving life, for consummating a marriage, and for the source of literally the seed that would that's nourished inside and developed inside the woman's womb that provides life, the greatest joy in the world. And it's of the flesh, my friend, that the single greatest achievement, the single greatest joy in this life produces. It is in our flesh that men and women come together and we conceive children.
Yep.
And there is no greater joy. I mean, marriage is a wonderful institution. I'm all for it. But I want to tell you, the greatest part of marriage by far is children. And I love my wife. But, most married guys, and I want to tell you, it's even more true of most married women. As much as we love our spouses, we love our children more. You know, there's this sense of joy and satisfaction and love and purpose of conceiving children. And I'm going to tell you, last time I checked, you can't do anything that's more in the flesh. And so the sign of the covenant is the part of the male makeup, genitalia, that is responsible for those two connections, the consummating a marriage and conceiving a family. You know, God knew what he was talking about. He says, this is the place that I want you to remember the covenant. If I make the sign of the covenant in the place that you consummate a marriage and that you build a family, there's a good chance that you'll get it, that you'll understand that this is exactly what I'm creating.
Yada, can a person who's uncircumcised even take part, even observe Pesach?
Only if you're a woman.
Right. I mean, man.
No.
Obviously, it can't be done.
Can't be done. God says absolutely not. If you are not circumcised as a man, you cannot participate in Passover. And, Larry, what's the consequence of not being able to benefit from Passover?
Well, then death. You're disinherited, period.
Right. Death. I mean, it's disinherited goes down the road there a bit, but death. Passover is
inherited, same as death. I mean,
if you're not part of God's family, you're going to die. That's true. But death. So there can be no uncircumcised male that is saved. When God is speaking of his return and he's creating his millennial temple, and he's talking to during those 5 days where he's judging the world, and he's talking particularly to Yehuda, to Israelites at that time. And he says that, you know, I've got a grievance. In fact, I'm going to tell you that of all of the things that have ever happened, this is my single biggest grievance. He does this in Ezekiel. So I'm really asking him. It's a tough question because he only brings this up once. So I'm pushing the threshold here by asking you, do you know what God said was the single greatest crime from his perspective, the thing that annoyed him the most that a Jew had done that was a counter to his covenant and to his home and his family?
Speak against circumcision?
You got it.
Mm-hmm.
He said that inviting, pretending that you can invite people into my home who are not circumcised, both of the spirit and of the flesh, is an abomination.
And that would be and.
Yeah, you know. And. And so what he's saying is that Paul, who made this the crucible, Paul made this the fulcrum of his message, is that if you're crucified, if you're circumcised, then you have no hope of salvation. That's what he said. If you're circumcised, then you are precluded from Pauline or therefore Christian salvation. And what he did is he equated circumcision with the flesh and said, that's bad. And if you're circumcised, you're not coming into heaven. You are excluded. And what God has said is that, you know, there's a Jew that promoted this myth. And we're not talking about a myth that affected 5 people or 100 people, but a billion people.
Billions
of people. That he said, you don't need to be circumcised. In fact, being circumcised is counterproductive. Welcome. You're just right on invited into God's home. And he says, no. That's the single biggest abomination that's ever been perpetrated by a Jew. Now, why did he say that?
Because what is circumcision? Well, it's a sign of the covenant for all time, for all generations.
And what's God's number one priority?
Well, the covenant.
Right. So if you are going to deny the single most important thing, which is the covenant relationship, by denouncing its sign, then what you're doing is an egregious abomination. And that's the basis of Pauline doctrine. And, you know, if you're a Christian, you need to be really careful because Paul's the founder of the Christian religion. You remove Paul and there is no religion of Christianity.
Yeah, I think we went over this the other day. There is no church.
No.
Yahusha didn't speak of a church. He spoke of his mikra.
Right.
Those 7 steps that God is always talking about here.
Right.
Starting with Pesach, ending with Sukkah. He spoke of his Moed Mikra, and in Greek that became Ecclesia. Then it was wiped out and replaced with a religious institution called a church, replete with religious books and paid clergy and little outfits and worship services and symbols and all kinds of things that Yahweh warned us against. You know?
So here we are. God is presented the nature of the Garden of Eden, this protective enclosure that's conducive to life, that is as the place of pure joy and satisfaction. And he created the man in his image with a nesama, with a nefesh, with a physical body as well, to enjoy this environment with him so they could have a relationship, and then to fully understand what God was offering and the nature of his covenant and of the family and the home that is represented by the covenant. He created woman in this way, using terms that would enlighten our journey as we seek to know him. We have Jason on the line. Jason, we may run out of time in this segment, but we'll continue whatever thoughts you may have in the next segment. Welcome, Jason. It's always good to hear from you.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I just I was thinking the other day about Paul's statement about the messenger of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thought, like, isn't there some passage in there where he says, like, even if an angel from heaven gives you any other message than mine,
right,
then you tell him to go to hell?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
What's that
about? Yeah, well, what Paul specifically said in his second letter to the Corinthians is that he was demon-possessed. The thorn in his side that Christians ponder and say, oh, I wonder what if that might have been. Paul answers the question. He says it's a messenger from Satan. A messenger from Satan is a demon. He was demon-possessed. And then and in the midst of that conversation, he then speaks of Yahweh's messengers. We'll return in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We are having a conversation with Jason, who called in from Toronto. Jason, it's really fascinating here that this is the point that you just brought out, which is Paul's statement. And let me read it to you. It said, let God's curse fall on anyone, including us, or even an angel from heaven, who preaches a different kind of gospel than the one that we preached to you. You know where that's actually found?
I was just looking it up. It's actually in one of the nastiest letters.
Yeah, it's the first letter Paul wrote. Yeah, it's in the first letter Paul wrote. It's in Galatians. It's the second sentence of Galatians.
Stunning.
Now, in the first sentence of Galatians, Paul calls the old system, which has become known to Christians as the Old Testament. He called the old system pornographic, corrupt, twisted, malevolent, mean-spirited, counterproductive. And so he has denounced the Torah and the prophets, what became known as the Old Testament. He uses the term old system as being porneo. Then his next statement is, now, even if a messenger from heaven were to preach a different story than the one that I've just told you, then let him be cursed. Now, here's the reality. There's only one story, Scott's got. That story is articulated in the Torah. It's advanced through the prophets. It was lived by Yahusha. He's only got one story. Only got one covenant, one message, one God, one story, one path, one relationship. It's just one. Paul came up with an entirely different one. It was based on Gnosticism to make it more appealing. And Paul, what he's saying here is that, yeah, if anybody tells you that there's a different anything different than what I'm telling you, then, you know, he's cursed. And what's stunning here is that Paul's message, of course, is diametrically opposed to God's, diametrically opposed to Yahusha's, diametrically opposed to the disciples. And he's saying, you know, you need to disregard everything God said. And you need to accept everything that I say, and if anybody tells you otherwise, they're going to hell. It's interesting, too, that, you know, Paul makes this big point about how the problem with the Torah is that it has to be obeyed. Now, of course, God doesn't even have a word for obey. There's not even a Hebrew word for obey. And, you know, teaching isn't obeyed, it's learned. You benefit from teaching. But nonetheless, Paul says the problem with the Torah is that you have to obey all of it or it will condemn you. Now, that's not what the Torah says, by the way. But then when Paul lays out his faith, he says that you have to obey it. And if you don't obey it, you're going to hell. And if you don't obey it, you're his enemy. You're going to be condemned. You know, the guy was the ultimate hypocrite. I mean, you just can't imagine a bigger hypocrite, a more just irrational and evil man. Now, we began this program, Jason, talking about being psychotic and how an individual that is psychotic cannot exercise good judgment. Do you know that Paul, in addition to admitting that he was demon-possessed, which he did in the second letter to the Corinthians, do you know that Paul also admitted to being insane?
I remember you going through that once before, yeah. And it was just a drop in the bucket at this point, you know.
I agree, it's a drop in the bucket for the founder of the Christian religion to say, "I am demon possessed, I am insane." But why, when he made the statement, and then his letters prove it, because the internal contradictions are just prolific, because every time he attempts to quote from the Torah, he misquotes it, and because his letters are just filled with what are called logical fallacies. When he proves through his writing that he's insane, why do billions of people prefer to believe him as opposed to come to know and trust Yahweh?
Well, like I mentioned once before, I think I was, you know, the fact that it's in the canon, a lot of people just, you know, they don't want to go against the grain, I guess, or whatever. They want people to make it obvious to them, which is, you know, what you're doing here. And, you know, I've definitely benefited from that. I just took somebody to point out these glaring problems.
Yeah, with Paul. It is so obvious that Paul was a liar, that he was insane, that he was demon-possessed, that he was opposed to God, that he was irrational. It is so stunningly obvious, and yet you've got the largest religion in the world that's lapping up his poison as it was Kool-Aid. Jason, thank you for calling. Larry, thank you for participating. We'll be with you this time tomorrow. May Yah bless.